Hello, I'm Alan Kohler, Editor-in-Chief of Eureka Report, and joining me today is Alex Pollock, Chief Investment Officer and founder of Loftus Peak Investment Firm. Alex, g'day. Welcome to Money Cafe.
Al, thank you for having me on. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, I think a good way to start would be you just telling us what you do.
Well, we set up this business 7 years ago, and it's a sort of a business that just, you know, sticks away from index investment for a whole bunch of obvious reasons, because the index companies are being disrupted. And we wanted to be in the companies that were performing better than the index companies. So it's a sort of a disruption fund. Well, it is a disruption fund. And we've been going for sort of 7 or 8 years right now.
And tell us what your performance has been since inception.
It's 20 plus percent per annum since 2013, with about 800 or 900 points of outperformance each year. So performance has been good.
Phenomenal. So what sort of things have you been investing in?
Well, you know, we made early on in the piece in 2013, 14, 15, we jumped into a whole lot of what they call the FANG stocks now, and we've done incredibly well out of those. And in 13, 14, 15, a lot of those companies had not yet kind of fully reached their potential or weren't, you know, actually executing the business models that they had in their business plans, and so there was a bit more to run.
So we're talking about Facebook, Google, Apple, Amazon.
Yeah, Netflix, Amazon, et cetera, Microsoft, those sorts of things. But you can't but as time has gone on, and Alibaba and Tencent as well from the Chinese perspective, but as time has come on, those returns are still quite good. But to get to the risk-adjusted returns that we've had, we're into a whole lot of stuff that people probably wouldn't know, like NVIDIA, Roku, Qualcomm, Xilinx, a whole bunch of those kinds of companies that are absolutely critical to the next phase of disruption, and have been really, really strong performers for us and underpin that return, again, risk-adjusted. Like if you just bought one stock, sure, you could have done the same numbers that we'd have, but risk-adjusted, that would be a terrible, terrible, unwise thing to do in case...
By risk-adjusted, you mean, you know, just accounting for the risk, and is the main way that you achieve the elimination or the reduction of risk is diversification?
Yes, diversification around different themes and different companies within the themes, and we look for the bottlenecks. For example, one of the bottlenecks in the rollout of machine learning was processing power, and the way the processing power bottleneck was dealt with was through companies like NVIDIA and Xilinx, which enabled massive parallel processing. For example, simple answer on this is that Google fields 67,000 inquiries per second. There is not an amount of white-coated people in the world that could ever answer that volume of queries. It can only be done through machine learning. And so the bottleneck there was the tools such as NVIDIA and Xilinx, which we invested into heavily.
Right. And before we get into individual stocks, and perhaps we can come back to NVIDIA and Xilinx, perhaps we can hop into the helicopter and go to 10,000 feet and just kind of give us a sense of what you reckon where we're at with the disruption. I mean, as you say, the initial disruption wave was the FANGs, the Facebook and Amazon and so on. I mean, do you think that the disruption theme has still got further to go? I mean, how far into the revolution are we, Alex?
Well, the answer to the question is, although we've come a really, really long way, for example, e-commerce is still only 70% of total commerce in the United States. So there's a lot more e-commerce to run. So that's one simple thing. But the real things that we're focused on right now are decarbonization. So decarbonization, you know, the end of oil, and I don't say that it's going to be finished because there's still going to be oil in various parts of the economy, and that's all good, right? But over time, the volume of with the use of oil as a fuel will diminish, and that we refer to that as the decarbonization economy. And the fuel, you know, obviously comes from things that we know about: wind, solar, geothermal, hydroelectric, etc. But also things like hydrogen as well are part of the decarbonisation equation and really have to become very, very large in the next 5 or 10 years.
So how are you investing
in... That's what Biden's flagging, etc.
How are you investing in decarbonisation? Because there's not much to do. You can't really invest much in hydrogen at the moment. So what do you do?
No, there's a lot of... there are a lot of ways to play hydrogen. We're spending a lot of time thinking about those ways to find, as it were, the bottlenecks in the same way that we look for the bottlenecks inside of machine learning. But before we even get to hydrogen, that's just one part of it, right? And another part of the simple decarbonisation story, obviously, has been Tesla, right? Because you move from cars powered by oil to cars powered by batteries, and if the batteries are powered by renewables such as wind and solar, that solves that question. So, but Tesla, we think that Tesla is enormously expensive right now. And so because we're a disruption fund, it means that we're not just into tech, we're not a technology fund. We look for companies that are remaking their business in disruptive manners. So if you think about it simply, even the Fairfax papers in Australia are increasingly rely on online to be able to execute their models, and so are disrupting themselves. So VW is a company that has been making petrol engines for a very long time, and as well as diesel itself. It has now committed to a fully electric suite of cars, and we're very careful that companies aren't greenwashing, but actually are doing what they say they're doing. And so VW is a part of our investment suite, because what we see in VW is the capacity, and they've built their first electric motors, obviously, and have scaled that up, and that there will be 20 million electric VW motors across their family of brands, Seat, Skoda, VW, Audi, Porsche, in the next 3 or 4 years. And VW will be the scale player. And the scale player obviously will enjoy the cost advantages. And because of that, that is a disruption story, an old company, but disrupting itself. And as the scale player, there's a decarbonisation decarbonisation story to play there.
So you're buying Volkswagen, not Tesla.
Correct.
Right. I saw.
We're not in Tesla at all. We left Tesla 6 months ago. We left a little bit of money on the table. Not that much. We made 10 times our money on Tesla. That's all fine. But it's priced for a heroic growth in the next 5 to 7 years, and that's all fine. We just think we can have heroic growth at a very much reduced price if we're clever about how we invest in it.
Heath Benke of Holon Investments in Sydney put out a report the other day saying that Tesla's worth, I don't know, more than $3,000 a share.
You can make the model say whatever you like, frankly, but if you test those assumptions through the models, they are, in our view, unless he knows something that we don't, and it's easily possible that he does, but in our view, the only way to get to those kinds of prices is to make simply heroic assumptions. We're not in that business. That's what I mean about risk-adjusted return, right? Because if he doesn't make those, if Tesla doesn't deliver those kinds of heroically assumptioned outcomes, that's a problem.
Yeah. So while we're on the subject of Elon Musk, what do you think of the space industries?
Well, the space industries, it's not a new story, right? The reason that we're in space from the very beginning is for the simple, because it was he who controlled the skies controlled defense and defense security, and that's why the Americans and the Russians were involved in the space race in the 50s and 60s and 70s, and no surprises there at all. But defense will be a part of what's going on with respect to space going forward. But also simple things around, connectivity, internet connectivity, and in countries where, for example, where infrastructure is not good enough, and where it would be cheaper and more effective to deliver it from the sky. So we see it, we understand it, we think, but we also think it's a little early to invest. You can't be too early on any of this stuff. Like quantum computing is out there in 5 or 10 years' time, but it's just too early. So, you know, some things you can't invest in because you've got to attend to the risk involved in these things in order to generate return, because people have to be able to come and go. I mean, we invest for superannuants, and tomorrow they might go into the fund and they want to get out in 4 days' time. They need liquidity, they need clarity, they need to be able to come and go as they need because they need to run their lives.
I think you've got you put out occasional insights.
That's right.
That's your phone.
That is my phone.
You put out occasional insights on your website. You've got one coming out today. What are you going to say?
Goldman Sachs has got a terrific paper out this week entitled TechMate, T-E-C-H, mate. And it just simply, you know, talks about a lot of the themes that really we've been talking about for 7 years. And to their credit, Goldman Sachs has raised many of them over the time as well. And simply pointing out that, you know, the returns of the companies, such as the ones that we are in, are, you know, double or triple since 2009. That of the, you know, S&P 500, excluding those companies. I mean, it's pretty simple stuff, but it's not nicely put together, and so we've made it a kind of discussion point around our commentary this week.
Right.
This month.
Are you investing in artificial intelligence? And if so, how?
Well, we've been in artificial intelligence for 5-6 years. That's what NVIDIA is about. That's what Xilinx is about. Frankly, that's what Qualcomm's about. People call it artificial intelligence, but it's just, that's a funny sort of term and we don't like it all that much. It's machine learning. Machine learning is, you know, when you get an email and Google, for argument's sake, says at the bottom, offers you three responses at the bottom, you know, yes, no, maybe. That's machine learning because they kind of read the text, and that doesn't mean that a guy in a white coat reads the text, because that's impossible at a scaled point or at any scale. But it means that it reads the text and it suggests some answers that might be appropriate. That's all that machine learning is, right? But to do it at scale is not trivial, and so that's why. You know, people call it artificial intelligence. There's not much intelligence in it, Al. It's just, you know, the wisdom of billions and billions of particular ways that people respond to things turned into responses suggested by the machines that are, you know, that you're using to make the responses.
So what do NVIDIA and Xilinx make?
Well, NVIDIA makes graphics processing units, but it's moved on from that entirely. What NVIDIA does is, the simple architecture of this is as follows. All computing, so to speak, 10 or 15 or 20 years ago, pretty much went through the central processing unit. And so that worked fine, but that was the bottleneck, so to speak. And as processing power went up and more, you know, people wanted to find out the quickest way to go between here and, you know, Melbourne, and so they needed to use Google Maps to do it, et cetera, et cetera. In order to do that, you needed to move away from central processing unit because it would have taken hours for millions of people to put in millions of destinations millions of times. What Xilinx and NVIDIA do is they parallel process. In other words, not everything runs through the CPU. Things run through these separate cores away from the CPU. And so there are tens of thousands of, so to speak, cores in this, and they each have their little part to play, but putting it all together gives you an answer. So it's parallel processing. That's what they do.
Right. And they're facilitating the massive kind of scaling up of the internet, as it were.
Hmm. Right. And you see this, Google talks about TensorFlow. That's one of their AI chips doing the same thing. They're all talking about, they've been doing it for years, right? This is not new. You cannot use these tools that appear on your PC that are just tools to deliver goods from, you know, New York to Sydney or whatever. those tools don't work unless they're parallel processed, because it's a scale game in the end. And so that's why we don't refer to it as artificial intelligence, because there's nothing that much. The thing that it's doing is not too bright. What it actually is doing is processing at great scale. Another one is John Deere. We're a company that also invests itself, the agricultural equipment maker. You will appreciate. So what Deere has done is it's put sensors on the tractors. It's been a great performing stock for us. And so the tractors and the farm equipment and the harvesters, et cetera, know the depth of every seed that is planted and the moisture content of all the soil in which it's planted and the particular topography of the ground it's planted in. And you might think, well, that's kind of trivial. It's just a field and it's this and that. But actually, you might be dealing with 5 million seeds. And so you need to understand which ones work and which ones don't. We need to feed a population of 7 or 8 billion people on the planet. Precision agriculture is where we're going. And again, you can't do that without massive processing power, parallel processing power.
So you're investing in John Deere as a technology disruptor, are you?
Oh, totally, yeah. We've been in it for a while.
Fascinating.
Great performer.
Yeah, right. That's fascinating. What do you think about blockchain and cryptocurrency? Are they disrupting?
Look, yes, that I do. I mean, to us, blockchain looks like an asset, like gold or, you know, diamonds or something like that, rather than a fiat currency in that
sense. You mean Bitcoin?
Bitcoin. But the blockchain itself, thank you, you're quite right. I answered the question too quickly. But the blockchain itself is useful because the blockchain removes layers of cost, because instead of having to have everything notarized and, you know, confirmed by signature, et cetera, some of that blockchain will enable that to happen. But again, that's more, it's a cost out story rather than a revenue growth story. So, and you know, the biggest beneficiaries of blockchain to me look like they're the banks globally, and the accounting firms as well, and, you know, possibly solicitors, et cetera. But it's a slightly hard one for us. We look at it, but we're not certain.
Ethereum's being used for a lot of what they call decentralized finance.
Yeah.
Which seems to be, how can I put it, nascently disruptive? Have you been looking at that?
Look, we've looked at it. Look, again, it's what I said earlier, risk adjusted. You know, we may have a bet ultimately, or may invest ultimately, but it would be small. I mean, the way we run our portfolio is 80% of the businesses in the portfolio are well-established businesses with great cash flows, you know, hugely profitable and with terrific adjacencies and great growth profiles. A small component, like less than 10% of our businesses, are what we call sort of at the riskier end. So we control the risk for the choke of the position size, which means that we might have a 1% or 2% bet on Ethereum in the same way that we have other bets. Once upon a time, Tesla was a 1% or 2% bet, which we scaled up and scaled up and scaled up. So we control, and that's what I meant about risk adjusted, we control the risk through the choke of the position size. And in that way, we have exposure to some of the stuff that's kind of a bit more edgy, while at the same time delivering great returns from the companies that are working right now, the Apples and the Googles and the NVIDIAs, which has been a superb performer, and Xilinx, Qualcomm, et cetera, et cetera.
One of the most disruptive events, of course, has been the pandemic, COVID-19. Have you been thinking about and investing in a post-COVID world, and what does that look like?
Well, we didn't change anything as a result of COVID, because all of the companies that we invest in have always been part of the distance commerce solutions. So, you know, there's a great chart that Microsoft puts out that said, you know, in the 10 years to 2020, e-commerce grew at 1% a year and stood at 15% at that point. And in 6 weeks, e-commerce went from 15 to 26%. It's a Microsoft chart, but it's based on the US Department of Commerce. So we didn't change. So we were already there, right? We were part of all the companies in which we invest were part of the distance solution, because they removed layers of unnecessary supply chain and delivery chain elements. In other words, instead of having you having to go and get something from somewhere, et cetera, it was loaded onto a truck and you knew when the truck was arriving and so you were home, because connectivity enabled people to be where they could say they were going to be and for things to happen quickly and at scale. And so we didn't really need to do anything with respect to the portfolio as a result of COVID. And to be frank, all the stuff that we're still in is still highly relevant in a post-COVID world. I think one of the things that we didn't get right was that we didn't sufficiently invest in the solutions around COVID, which is the Modernas and the BioNTechs and the Pfizers and such like that. But we have remedied that recently, not so much by way of investing in those particular companies, but we've always had a thematic which was genetic medicine and genetics, and we're particularly interested in gene editing right now, and so we're thinking through what that means, and that is one change that's come as a result of COVID.
Are you taking any notice of the argument about whether inflation is transitory or not?
I'm taking tremendous notice of that. I honestly don't know, Alan. I don't think inflation's a couple of percent. What's happening is all the discounting, first of all, has come out of the system, point one. So in the initial stages, the discounting, you know, is responsible for prices that were down at sort of, you know, 60 or 70% of what the rack rate might have been. Well, all the discounting has come out of the system, and so suddenly it's gone from 70% of the price to 100% of the price, and that's on a whole range of goods. One. And two, this sort of inflation that we're seeing obviously is supply side based, meaning that companies charge heavily because they simply can't get the raw materials and even the, you know, ETM, elaborately transformed manufacturers to sell their products. But it's real, we think. We don't know how to quantify it, and we're watching it very closely. But yeah, rates will rise.
We're just about out of time. Alex, we've got a couple of questions. I'm not sure they're aimed specifically at you, but anyway, here's one from Dan.
Oh, yeah?
Dan, not my real name. Why not, Dan? We don't know who you are. Anyway, Dan, not my real name.
Maybe his name's Dan, not my real name.
Yeah, that's an interesting surname. We all know that the great migration from capital cities to regional towns is putting those regional housing markets on steroids in an already extraordinarily hot market thanks to low interest rates. The theory goes many capital city dwellers are now able to work from home in more remote locations. But how sustainable is this? I think it's easy to get a job and then negotiate a work from home setup, but I don't think it's easy to get a remote job without first building trust with your employer from wherever they are based. What do you think? Well, what do you think?
I think Dan, not his real name, is on the money there. You know, you can't build culture remotely, in my view. So you do, you know, there has to be some work. You can certainly do work from home once you've established what the culture is. Culture, we like to think of, is what happens between meetings. And, you know, it is important, I think, for people to spend time in the office. But you know, those things can be solved after a few months, and people can work from home very efficiently. We've been doing it for months, even longer.
There you are. And I'm sure you've been investing in things like Zoom that are taking advantage of it.
Perhaps. Well, there you go.
There you go. The other question is not really a question. He just wants to know, when do we announce our guest for the show? And we've been doing it a bit late, so we need to announce the guest earlier so they can ask you questions.
Ah, very good.
But that's it, Alex. Thanks very much for your time today. It's been great.
Thanks for thinking of us, Al. We love being here.
Yeah, good. Thanks everyone for listening to today's episode of Money Cafe. Send in your question and we'll get to it next week. You can email themoneycafe@eurekareport.com.au. Until next week, I'm Alan Kohler, Editor-in-Chief of Eureka Report, and he's Alec Pollock, Founder and Chief Investment Officer of Loftus Peak.
Thanks to all.
Talk to you soon.